This is John DeRemus, and I'm very pleased to introduce Strategies for Stress-Free Living by Dr. Clay Sherman. While the topics of stress and its effects on our physical and mental well-being have been approached by numerous authorities, Dr. Sherman's presentation in these six cassettes is exceptional in that it not only discusses the consequences of stress, but also provides clear, specific examples of the day-to-day stressors experienced by us all in our professional and personal environments. And perhaps even more important, Sherman offers several suggestions of easily accomplished stress remedies. Clay Sherman is Executive Vice President of Beta Group Limited, a management consulting firm specializing in management education and human resources programming for industrial, governmental, academic, and health service organizations. He received his undergraduate degree in psychology from Brigham Young University and his Master of Business Administration in Management and Doctorate in Management Education from Western Michigan University. His postdoctoral study was done at Harvard University's Graduate School of Business Administration in the area of managing organizational effectiveness. As a consultant to international corporations, associations, and health systems, Dr. Sherman designs and conducts approximately 140 executive retreats and managerial programs each year and is well known as a counselor to management, a managerial educator, and an advisor to executives as they plan their career development. He is the author of several research monographs, over 50 articles which have been published in various professional journals, and an internationally published executive development book entitled Managerial Performance and Promotability, The Making of an Executive. Dr. Sherman is also the author of one of Nightingale Conant's most popular management programs, The Uncommon Leader. On 18 cassettes in 3 volumes, The Uncommon Leader presents what many consider to be the MBA of the future: management concepts for the veteran executive and the rising leader. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Clay Sherman.
Recently in my local paper, one of my favorite columnists, Bob Green, wrote a column entitled No One Taking Time to Smell the Roses. He told the story of a restaurant with a unique policy about bringing diners their checks. When you order your dinner or lunch, your waiter writes down what you want. Then before bringing you your food, he presents you with your check and requests your money. This is not some fast food operation. It is a respected Boston restaurant, and you pay healthy prices for your meal and drinks. So the pay-first policy is surprising to people who are eating there for the first time. It's not that the management doesn't trust the customers to pay at the end of the meal. It's that they know the customers are twitching in their seats in anticipation of getting back to work or on their way to the next place they're supposed to be. To wait 2 or 3 minutes for a check would drive them crazy. It fits in with something that seems to be happening all over the country. For want of a better term, it might be called the twitching of America. All of a sudden, people seem to be in an insane hurry to get too much done in too little time. A reluctance to enjoy a meal and then wait a few minutes for the waiter to fetch the check is merely a symptom. If you look around you, you can see the twitching of America everywhere. There are people who will punch a button for an elevator, and if the elevator does not arrive within 5 seconds, they will begin punching the button again, repeatedly, or they will begin looking for a staircase. There are people whose faces become ruddy and flushed in traffic if the car in front of them pauses even momentarily before starting up again after the light turns green. There are people whose pulses begin to race if they call directory assistance and the operator does not answer before the third ring. There are people whose days are ruined if they have to stand in line at the bank. There are even people, while using a bank of pay telephones, attempt to carry on conversations on two phones at once if they're put on hold on the first line. They'll pick up a second line to start a new call while they're waiting. The so-called laid-back days of our society are definitely over. The twitching of America is claiming more victims every day. No one really enjoys it, but the inroads it is making are undeniable. There is something deeply unhealthy about all this. A society that has begun to value the clock so highly has got to be missing out on certain other aspects of a normal life. The cliche, of course, is stop and smell the roses. Now, not only have people ceased stopping to smell the roses, they resent it if someone who is smelling the roses happens to block their path on the sidewalk for 3 seconds. So they eat at restaurants that allow them to pay first, then hurry back to their offices to drum their fingers on their desk as they impatiently wait for their packages to be delivered, inside of which are documents which had to reach them overnight. What would have happened if the packages would have been sent via regular mail and would have taken 3 days instead of a half day to get there? Who knows? The important thing is, the phone has already rung twice, and the secretary hasn't picked it up yet. It's enough to drive a modern person right off the edge. And the evidence is that more and more people are either being driven off the edge or finding life increasingly difficult. Have you been going through life as a clenched fist? Do you feel like you're living in the pressure cooker of life? Are you concerned about a friend, a child, a mate that looks like an accident going someplace to happen? Then this program is for you. Our humor is revealing. A fellow walks into a psychiatrist's office. He says, "Doc, you gotta help me. Nobody talks to me." Shrink says, "Next." We're living in a time in which many people report feelings of depersonalization, of anonymity, of being alone, isolated, and alienated. They report feelings of anxiety and of being a member of the lonely crowd. It has become for many people an unpleasant time in which to live. Around us are all kinds of symptoms of the times in which we're living. There's a general concern and worry regarding crime and its growth in the United States. What is causing that change of behavior? We're aware that knowledge is increasing dramatically, actually doubling every 10 years. In certain advanced fields like electronics or medicine, knowledge is doubling every 5 years. How do you keep up with a changing career field? How do you keep on top of a world that does not seem to have the same kind of fixed points of reference that it used to have? One of the things that we know is that the times have become tougher. A recent drug advertisement said, "Times got tougher, we got stronger." The insidious nature of this advertising indicates that they increased the dosage levels of a popular painkiller because no one wants to take more than 2 pills. What is causing this change in the market that requires stronger medication? The Public Health Service tells us that in the United States last year, there were an estimated 1 million premature deaths. That is, deaths that need not have occurred. Many of the deaths that are alcohol-related, many of the drug-related deaths, many of the highway traffic deaths are known to be related to stress. The nature of these deaths indicates that these were deaths that occurred prematurely, unnecessarily. What is causing this dramatic increase in death-related illnesses that are connected to stress phenomena? The American Heart Association tells us that the percentage of the population that is experiencing premature heart attack and stroke, that is, a heart attack or stroke, suffered before the age of 60, when it would be considered a normal aging disease, has been increasing each year for the last 15 years. In the same 15-year period, the average age at which premature heart attack and stroke has been occurring has been decreasing. What is responsible for the trend line of these diseases? Around the turn of the century, stomach ulcer and colitis was generally considered to be a woman's disease, since about 90% of those suffering from those illnesses at that time were women. As the nature of life changed in the 20th century, it became more and more commonly a man's disease as the nature of his work relationships changed. Change, in fact, underlies many of the stress phenomena that we now witness in our society. In 1955, a benchmark year from which researchers generally started measuring stress changes, an interesting publication entitled Mad Magazine began rolling off the presses. The slogan of the chief character of that magazine, Alfred E. Newman, was, "What? Me worry?" And starting in the late 50s, the gag line, "What? Me worry?" began to symbolize some of the changes that people were finding occurring in their own lives. Return, if you would, to the late 1950s, those of you who are old enough to remember. Go back to your own childhood and think about what the times were like. In the late 1940s, when I grew up in a small town in Michigan, there was, within a mile of my home, literally a score of aunts, uncles, cousins, grandparents. There were all kinds of support people in our life. And when there was a problem in the family, when there was illness or a death, there was all of the support you could possibly ask for. In fact, often more help than you needed or wanted. In that era, it was not uncommon for people to be born, live their entire life, and even to die in the same town, sometimes even in the same home. And the concept of societal mobility was not yet a general phenomenon. In my parents' generation, the typical statistic was that a person could expect to live in an average of 1.8 homes. The current estimate is that 25% of the U.S. population will move this year, and that a teenager in the current generation can expect to live in over 11 homes during the course of his or her lifetime. Now, when you move from the place of family origin into the big city, the smaller town, or wherever you have moved over the course of your lifetime, and your family suffers some trauma or some illness or some trouble, who is it that you turn to for help? Is it the next-door neighbors whose names you don't even know? There have been other changes, changes within American society. Those changes have created a pattern of change in the types of illnesses that we suffer, in the pattern of interactions that we have or do not have with people, and even in the ways we think about ourselves. This has caused major changes in society. The times did get tougher. But have we gotten stronger? In my childhood years, I can well remember the fact that not only was there family support within the community, but there was also a magic triad that occurred between the family, the school, and church or synagogue. The parental values of discipline, of ethics, of morality, of views of the world were synonymous with those being presented in the school system and in the media and through the religious organizations that served us. And it was expected that church officials and school officials would act in loco parentis, in the place of the parent. I'd like you to consider what has happened to church attendance in the United States. Nearly all mainstream denominations have lost attendance and influence in terms of behavior guidance among the young. Consider, too, what has happened to the school system. We now have uniformed guards standing in the halls as teachers are totally unable to control and deal with the discipline problems that exist. Major sociological changes have occurred, and as these support mechanisms have eroded, parents have been left with an increasing inability to communicate and reach their own family members. Our humor is revealing. A fellow walks into a psychiatrist's office. "Doc, I don't have any friends. You gotta help me, you big fat slob." The aggressiveness, even hostility, of so much modern humor tells us something about ourselves. Have you noticed that people's driving habits on the road have become more aggressive than they were 10 years ago? Have you noticed the behavior of parents toward their children verbally and in some cases physically in the supermarkets and other public places? Have you noticed the change in general lack of respect and lack of culture and lack of manners being shown in normal human interactions, in sales transactions in department stores, in waiter and waitress behavior in restaurants, in all kinds of common situations? What has caused the change? And what are some of the impacts of that change? One of the things that we do know is that people require support mechanisms and a general structure and context within which appropriate behavior can be reinforced. When those structures break down, we are liable to see personal behaviors degenerate. Another statistic of our time concerns itself with abusive relationships within families. We know that wife beating and physical abuse has become widespread. One of the issues in the papers currently has to do with changing the law to allow wives to sue their husbands on charges of rape. One of the interesting studies recently shows that husband abuse also has been on the increase. As a matter of fact, one study reported that the percentage of husband beaters is approximately the same as that of wife beaters. Child abuse in the United States was first studied in the late 1940s. It was acknowledged even in that original study that they were underestimating the number of abuse cases at a rate of one case out of every 100,000 households. The most recent study estimates that in 10% of the homes in which children are present, there is some form of abusive parental behavior operating in one of the four common patterns: physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, or neglect. In that study just cited, the researchers also commented that it was their opinion that their statistics still understated the problem. A cover story in Newsweek magazine reported the phenomenon that approximately half of the children growing up in the United States are growing up in single-parent homes. I'd like you to consider what a single-parent home today is like compared to a single-parent home in 1955. Most single-parent homes in a previous generation were the result of the death of one parent. In the current situation, we're dealing with an extremely high divorce rate in which we treat family members as sometime things, and where the children are therefore left with a home situation in which the father is typically the one who is absent, and the mother, because of difficult economic times, finds it necessary to enter the workforce. Who is it that's going to take care of the children left at home? Sociologists and educators tell us that the most important learning takes place in the first few years of life. It is in that period of time that a child learns language, learns key values, where many of the personality structures are set, and of course the primary instructors or teachers are the parents, who are role models. Supposing that due to divorce the father is absent, and the mother, for economic reasons, must work outside the home, who is going to transmit personal and cultural values? Who will teach the children the correct ways of behaving? The answer, unfortunately, for too many, is television. It is estimated that by age 5, the year that they walk off to the public schools for the first time, children will have seen over 10,000 felonies committed on TV. 2,000 of those felonies will be homicides. And if you believe that a child can watch all of that and not be influenced, if you believe that a child at the most impressionable period of their life can watch violence as daily entertainment and not be affected by it, if you think there is no relationship between that exposure and the learning mechanisms going on within them, and that there is no relationship between all of that and the later violence and discipline problems that we have seen among the young, then I'll give you a lifetime pass to Disneyland. In my mother's generation, it was a shameful thing for a husband and wife to be divorced. I'd like you to consider how times have changed. We now understand that there is approximately a two-thirds possibility that a marriage will survive to the first anniversary. In Orange County, California, the possibility or probability that a marriage will make it to year one is 50%. times have changed dramatically. The abusive patterns, the crime patterns, the discipline problems, the tension, the anxiety, and the relationship of all these things to our physical health and to our mental well-being is certainly well documented. In 1955, the possibility that you would spend some time in a mental institution for treatment was 1 in 13. Today, your chances of being institutionalized at some point in your life are 1 in 7. Another interesting statistic is that suicide rates, which had been increasing for many of the last 20 years or so, seem to have leveled off in just the last 2 or 3 years. But one unfortunate statistic still emerges, and that is that teenage suicides are continuing to increase. Can you really imagine what kind of a world it is when a 13 or 14-year-old believes that there's no longer any value in continuing to live? Sometimes when we're under pressure and under stress and under strain, we have a tendency to believe that there must be something wrong with us. We come home at night with that tight feeling in the pit of our stomach. We come home with the anger that is difficult to express. We have that seething internal reaction, and we have difficulty in verbalizing it. And as we walk in the door and turn against our family members, those who love us more than anyone else, we begin to think of ourselves in terms of guilt and in terms of worry about what is wrong with us. The first suggestion that I would offer is that there may be nothing wrong with you at all. In fact, what we see in the way of stress symptoms and stress reactions are normal reactions to abnormal situations. Let me state that again. Stress reactions are a normal response to an abnormal situation. You would have to be abnormal not to react with anger and frustration and difficulty and worry and anxiety to this brave new world that has been created. What we have to do in stress management, and the focus of much of this program, is to take careful consideration of what is going on around us and see how we can use our normal responses in a constructive way and how we can avoid being exposed to those things which are abnormal in the environment and which create many of the difficulties that I have described. Our humor reveals our anxiety. Jokes that we tell of family members, of mothers-in-law, of sexual innuendo, stories of psychiatrist relationships with parents fill our daily conversation. They reveal people who are uptight, tense, and having difficulty. A fellow walks into a psychiatrist's office and he's all nervous and he's shaking, jittery, and he says, "Doc, Doc, you gotta test me. I feel I have an inferiority complex." And the doctor says, "Take it easy, young man. We'll test you. We'll find out." So he gives him 8 hours of the Rorschach and all of the ink blots and sprinkles the magic pixie dust on him. And at the end of the 8 hours, he says, "Young man, I have good news for you. You do not have an inferiority complex. You are inferior." The guy says, "Well, geez, Doc, can I get a second opinion?" He says, "Okay, I'll give you a second opinion. You're ugly, too." In our humor is revealed our own sense of inadequacy and our own sense of difficulty. The stress paradigm is a tentative model of how we think stress operates. It should be noted that much of the stress research that we have dates only from the late 50s, and over the last 25 to 30 years have we really begun to study this phenomenon in any great depth. In part, that's because it is a new disease entity that is occurring on a wide scale. Some of the conclusions, therefore, that the stress researchers have reached are still only tentative. In terms of how we think stress phenomenon impact on each of us as we go through a difficult and trying period of time, the stress model has a number of basic underlying concepts which, if understood, will give us a number of tools and strategies for how to deal with stress. So let's consider each portion of the model individually and then look at what the related stress management strategies are. First, it pictures all people as being bombarded daily with stress. Any person, any situation, any event, any arena that provides for you a stressful experience or a difficult experience is called a stressor. My father, who once heard me do a program on this subject and who for many years was an electronics company president, said he had some difficulty in relating to this subject because he had never experienced stress, that he had just been a carrier. Whether that stressor is a traffic jam, whether it's being caught in a toll lane with no change, whether it is an argument with the spouse or a difficult relationship with your boss, any of these situations can provide some level of stress. Picture stress as being a weight. All of us can deal with certain problems and difficulties. All of us have a tough row to hoe. All of us have a cross to bear. All of us have to deal and can deal quite successfully with a certain level or load of stress. And we can carry this load on our back. In the ancient Greek myth, Atlas is pictured as carrying the world on his shoulders. Well, we are not like Atlas. We cannot carry an unbelievably heavy load. There is a limit to the amount of load or the amount of stressors that we can deal with. And while we can handle some, we cannot handle all, and therefore it's important to clearly identify the amount of stress that we are each contending with. Jeremiah Denton was the ranking officer in the Vietnam prisoner of war camps. He came back to the United States as a well-received hero and later was elected to the United States Senate. In a remarkable interview, he made this comment. "We learned," he said, "in Vietnam that all of us, have a breaking point." And the interviewer pointedly asked, "Did you learn that lesson about yourself as well?" And he indicated that he had suffered a breakdown under the unbelievable pressures imposed on him in prison life. All of us have a breaking point. Some of us pride ourselves on the fact that we are the Iron Maiden or the Iron Man who can handle it all, and we pride ourselves on this great strength. Yet that's a false pride, because we know that under the right set of circumstances, under sufficient load, anybody can be broken. You are not iron. You are flesh and blood. You are human.